This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I am discussing medication safety in pregnancy with PharmD, Dr. Sierra Richard. Have a listen. Okay, thanks for joining us today. I am with Dr. Sierra Richard. She is a PharmD and a women's health and pediatric pharmacist known as at Happy Farm Life on Instagram. Is that right?
Yes.
And where else can they find you on social media?
My other primary platform is on YouTube, and I do a lot of videos where I just show a day in life as a pharmacist and kind of talk about the clinical things that come up as a pharmacist in the women's health and pediatric space.
Perfect. Do you go by your name on YouTube, or what do you go by on YouTube?
Happy Farm Life as well.
Okay. I say Happy Farm Life on Instagram and Happy Farm Life on YouTube. So we kind of, as most of the time, I get to know people through, I see how people comment on my post. And that's what caught my eye about you, because I do have collaborated some with PharmDs, but I love to do this because, yes, I'm trained about medications in pregnancy. Obviously, that's what I do. But you guys add an extra something that I don't have. So I think it's really cool that we're doing this today. And basically what we're going to do is kind of go through the history of why it's hard to do studies in pregnancy, and kind of go through a timeline of where we are to get to where we are today, and then what we can do to improve things. We're going to also talk about how drugs are now classified, because I know most people are listening or thinking that drugs are still classified as the A, B, C, D, and X, and they're not. So we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to give you guys some good resources. So does that sound good to you, Dr. Richard?
Sounds excellent.
Okay, let's start from the beginning. And we've heard a lot of this coming through, especially with the COVID vaccine and pregnancy, and that's what happened with thalidomide. So first, tell us what thalidomide was. And one thing I learned when I was researching this is that it was not available in the United States, right?
That is correct. So it was actually a drug that was frequently used for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. And this drug was used widely at the time in Europe and Canada. And so a lot of patients were taking this medication because, as we know, pregnancy can cause a lot of nausea and vomiting, especially in that first trimester. So a lot of these patients were taking it, and there wasn't really any studies done. There was no standard to have any studies done in pregnancy at that time. And so patients were taking this medication and had no idea of the potential effects to the fetus. And what they found, unfortunately, later on, after many patients gave birth to babies with horrible limb deformities. If you've never heard about thalidomide, you should definitely check it out. Just do a quick Google search and kind of see what happened to these patients. But that is where there was like an, oh no, we actually have never really thought about what's going to happen to the baby if mom takes medications. And so researchers kind of panicked, and they were really wanting to take a very cautious approach to females in clinical trials, and they kind of went overboard. So In 1977, the FDA created a policy that recommended that women be completely excluded from clinical trials in phase 1 and 2. That's where a lot of the safety data comes in. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't matter, though, if these women were single, if they agreed to not have any sort of sexual intercourse, or if they were on contraceptives, if their husband had had a vasectomy. It didn't matter. Just all women were excluded, which really was a detriment to not only pregnancy, but just women in general.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, again, you talked about thalidomide, and people bring that up all the time. And yes, it was terrible, but it ended up being a really great learning lesson, because when we start going through this time, you'll see how long it's taken for things to evolve from when thalidomide happened, which was in, 1977? Around that time, mm-hmm. to what you just mentioned with excluding just all females or egg-producing individuals from trials altogether. And then in 1979 is when the pregnancy category labeling system was established. And that was with A, B, C, D, or X. And what was the purpose behind, a little bit of background, is how did they come up with the A, B, C, D, and X?
And so those different categories are really based on the studies that we had. And unfortunately, like we mentioned, a lot of women were excluded from those studies. So there was a lot of limited data that goes to that. So I'll go ahead and go through what each of those categories kind of meant. But before I do that, I want to point out that this is for pregnancy only. There is different labelings for lactation. This was not taken into consideration, lactation categories. I don't remember the year that they came out, but they were significantly later that that became a consideration. Pregnancy was much earlier on. And so when you went through the categories, category A was the best evidence. We have really good, well-controlled studies that determined that there was not a risk to the fetus. We've not seen any risk to that. So that's things like levothyroxine and folic acid, things that some of them have significant benefit in pregnancy, like folic acid. You talk about that on your page all the time. It's super important. And so then you have category B, which is they have animal studies that have not shown any risk to the fetus. And they typically do have some well-controlled studies in pregnant women. They're just maybe not as big or as good quality of study. So we use a lot of medications in this category. Metformin is one that we use for diabetes. Amoxicillin is a common antibiotic you can get during pregnancy. So those types of medications fall in that category, very unlikely to have significant risk. So category C then came along, and that was really, again, a lot of animal studies is the biggest piece of that. And it was shown to have adverse effects on the fetus. And then there was also no well-controlled or adequate studies in humans. But in the category C is kind of the biggest gray area, I would say, out of all of these, where there is some animal studies that say there's risk. There's not great studies in humans, but there could be potential benefit that we might need this in. So gabapentin, which is a pain reliever, that is one of those medications that fall in that category that we sometimes give in pregnancy because we've used other options that are known to be safe and we need to use something else. Category D is where there is evidence in human studies that there is adverse risk associated with it. And then there's the small percentage of people who may actually benefit despite those potential risks. So losartan is one of those medications. There are several others. And that one is really where, you know, there's a good conversation happening with the provider. I frequently get called on to these cases where there's a category D medication that may be used. And I talk with the provider, sometimes with the patient as well, to kind of determine whether or not we want to go that route. And that's usually when we've exhausted all other options when we go to a category D medication. Is that what you've seen kind of here in practice with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, we as MFMs, we probably do actually follow more so, especially in academic medicine, more of what the new recommendations are. We don't look at the ABCD. And in fact, my institution is doing the pravastatin for prevention of preeclampsia, which pravastatin was a category X, but now it's been shown to be beneficial in pregnancy. It's not standard of care just yet for those with a history of preeclampsia, but it likely will be. So, you know, we're very research oriented and we kind of don't really rely on those. But I understand how providers would, because you kind of, by no fault of their own, kind of default to like the grading system. A is great, B is good, C is D is a no. We don't want a D, or we definitely don't want an X. But it made it easier for providers to just not even entertain those medications when in fact they might have been what the individual needed. So yeah, and then go ahead to category X.
Yeah, and so like you said, category X is, you know, exactly what it sounds like. It's a no. It's those things that we know that have fetal abnormalities associated with them. There's positive evidence of fetal risk in human studies. That's one thing I really, you may have noticed me emphasizing the animals versus human studies, because a lot of these categories were based off of animal studies, sometimes exclusively for certain drugs. And so the drug category of statins, those medications that we use to reduce lipids in people, and reduce the cholesterol, those are a medication that fall into that, methotrexate, which we tend to avoid. So those sorts of medications are category X. And in my practice are very similar. I work with a lot of residents, so they're kind of default to that, especially those in family medicine who are not in OBGYN. And so I kind of use that as an education point. And let's look at all of the data that's available instead of just the category, because there are patients that frequently would need something that's in the category C or D, and that is the best option for that patient. And we use those medications. So I'm really glad we've done kind of away with those categories, because sometimes they would put a little bit extra barrier in between a patient getting a medication that they truly needed.
Right. And you know, I'm not saying not to think about that. And obviously when you're counseling a patient, we're going to counsel based on what we do and don't know about a certain medication. But sometimes, like you said, depending on what the condition is in the pregnant individual, sometimes we have to give them medications to help them get through the pregnancy. And with counseling and the patient acceptance, that's what we do. And you know, it is what it is. You can't have a healthy pregnancy without a healthy individual. Obviously, we try the least, you know, you could talk, just add some of the things that we look for. The lowest effective dose, those types of things that we look for when prescribing in pregnancy. Those types of things we look at for any medication, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot of hesitancy and there's a lot of additional counseling that I think goes on in pregnancy. And I think that that's completely appropriate. But I'm glad that we have better data, because we'll talk a little bit later in this live. So, you know, keep watching where we talk about what we're doing now. And I think it's just so much better as a provider to really be able to look at those studies where you're not having to dig super far into something to try to figure out what the real risk and concern was. Because when you had just a category or a letter, it didn't really tell you a lot about what the risk and concern was to begin with, which is a very important factor to consider, is the risk versus benefit analysis there. So based on all of this, and we've moved on through the categories, we're going to move on to 1986. And that is when we finally had the National Institute of Health decide to encourage the inclusion of women in clinical trials. So I do want to point out here, between that 1977 and that 1986, patients were still being in trials. It was just not the clinical trials of phase one and phase two. And a lot of companies use that as an opportunity to exclude that population, mm-hmm. to make it easier to exclude women and minorities, because sometimes that would require extra funding to make sure you were including those people. And so that previous study kind of pushed them out, and that's very unfortunate in general, like I've said previously, but that was kind of where we started to get some encouragement of, hey, we do actually need women in clinical trials. And part of the reason we were seeing that is that we were finding that once these medications came to market, that some women were actually responding differently to certain medications mm-hmm. than what they anticipated. They were responding different to men, and that's kind of expected when you think mm-hmm. about how women and men are different, especially when we think about renal function and things like that. So it was exciting to see, you know, we were starting to get in the right direction, but we still weren't there because it was just an encouragement. It was definitely not required.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then it was just in 1986 is when we decided to include egg producing individuals or females and just try to, yes, we need to start doing this. So that was through the NIH. And then it's jumped to 1991. With the launch of the Women's Health Initiative through the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. What happened with that?
And so this was big because this is where funding started to happen. So the previous policy was just, again, a recommendation. There was no dollars around that. And unfortunately, in today's healthcare system, dollars are very important, especially when it comes to studies and inclusion of women in these studies. So there started to become guidelines where you had to include women or egg-producing individuals in studies, which was the first time that we really saw that. And then there was also requirements to analyze these studies by gender. And what's important here is, like I said before, we had found with other medications, there are certain medications that we do dose differently based on that. And so we were able to establish that in certain instances. Mm-hmm. And so then we also had the first female NIH director that actually came about in 1991 as well. And that's where the launch of the Women's Health Initiative really was. And that is huge for clinical trials and observation studies. I mean, that was where we were starting to see money going to things like diet modifications, postmenopausal hormone therapy, something that was completely ignored pretty much prior to this, calcium, vitamin D sublets, heart disease, fractures, breasts, and colorectal cancer, like so many disease states that were just not getting any money or funding for clinical trials were being added as well.
Yeah, and as a researcher who's had an NIH grants and has been on network studies, you know, and obviously all of my studies were in pregnant individuals, the NIH is huge in funding those types of studies. We do a lot of work into drafting those studies, including them, how the protocols are going to be done, the safety aspect of it, how this the data safety is going to be monitored. I mean, there's so much going into doing a study like this, especially a clinical trial in pregnant individuals. And rightfully so. I mean, you want to do it the right way. But without research dollars, it's really hard to do a clinical trial pretty much in anything in pregnancy. You really need those NIH mm-hmm. dollars, and not all institutions have that available to even allow the researchers to do it. So getting funding from the NIH is crucial to continuing research into things regarding pregnancy and lactation even, and even in those trying to conceive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where a huge barrier was prior yeah. to the creation of the Women's Health Initiative, because there, like I said, there was a lot of small studies. And what you will see when you look back at like some of the things that were being off-label use that we'll talk yeah. about a little yeah. bit about off-label later, a lot of the things that we're making conclusions on were very small trials done at individual institutions that were not readily funded to be widespread across multiple right. hospitals, which is what we really want to see in something right. like that. So it was really exciting to see that. And that was only the beginning. So in 1993, we finally had our first law get enacted. So prior to that, it was an NIH policy, which is great. We need that. That's where the dollars were coming from. But it wasn't a law across the board. So Congress passed the Women's and Minorities as Subjects in Clinical Research Act. And that really allowed women and minorities to be included, required to be included in clinical research, which was huge because a lot of egg producing individuals, of course, were not still being included. They were using the yeah. excuse of it being more expensive to include minorities. So especially egg producing individuals who were in minorities were almost non-existent yeah, yeah, in clinical studies. They were completely excluded. Yeah. Like they just weren't there at all. And so this made it to where cost was not an acceptable excuse for that. You had to recruit patients that were in minorities, subpopulations as well. And so that was really exciting because this was really kind of the shift where it became, this is a have to, not a, it'd be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, we'd rather not because it's too hard type of thing. So yeah. And most institutions will have something called an IRB or an institutional review board mm-hmm. where your studies will have to go through to be approved. And those are the things they look at. What the demographics of the study population are going to be like. And now the demographics are going to change depending on where you're located. And they understand that. But what you can't do is say, I'm only going to recruit white females or white egg producers. You know, we can no longer do that. It has to be as representative of the population that you're studying where you're at. So those types of laws really helped make that, you know, it's no longer a choice. It's something that you got to do. Okay. So
yeah, and that was great.
Yeah, yeah. It really made a difference. Okay, let's talk about in 1994 what the Office of Women's Health was.
So the Office of Women's Health is another institution that funds a lot of research to expand our knowledge on medication use and pregnancy and breastfeeding. And so they fund a lot of projects, including like artificial intelligence for vital pregnancies, a lot of our modeling that we use on pregnancies. A lot of information that I have found super helpful is about the drug passage in breast milk. Prior to this, we didn't have a lot of information on what molecules were actually getting passed through the breast milk and in what amounts. And so a lot of the research dollars came through that. And so at this point, we were seeing a lot more of that funding come through the Office of Women's Health.
Right. And then, that is still active today, actually. But what is the O, is that, how is that different from the ORWH? Or is there a difference? Because I see sometimes when I was doing my research on this, there's an ORWH and an OWH. So I'm not sure what the, maybe it's reproductive health or something. I'm not sure, but
I think it's reproductive health. Reproductive, yeah.
Reproductive. Yeah. So that's probably including, and I'm not sure, I'll have to go back and look at that, but they're probably same, but different in a way. Okay. And mm-hmm. then in 1998, was when we kind of started thinking about the pregnancy labeling and the ABCDX and whether or not it might be the best way to do things. Is that when that started?
Yes, and that was kind of where we addressed some of those things that we talked about. So the animal versus human studies was not distinguished in those label categories. And we really didn't get the full range of the differences in the developmental toxicity. So the thing is, sometimes there was drugs that would be a category D in the first trimester, but would be a category B in a later trimester. And that caused a lot of confusion because sometimes people were not using those medications later on in pregnancy, even though it was appropriate. And that might be a great time to use that medication because we had data on it for later on that said that it was safe. And so you were getting a lot of confusion with this labeling category. It was a little too much, sometimes black and white, on whether or not it should be used. And we weren't able to see the data that was behind the decision to make that labeling category, which was difficult. You know, you could go digging for that information, but it was not upfront on the package insert and easy to find. So this is where we really started seeing that shift of, well, maybe we should make it to where we have more clinical decisions available, where we can see the information, where that category and that letter label isn't just so definitive, but we can see what all information has been presented and then make the best clinical decision for that specific patient. So this labeling that they started thinking about here was more broad than what those letter categories provided. So we can have more meaningful discussions based on the animal studies and the human studies and really making that risk versus benefit evaluation that is so important in pregnancy.
Right. So then 10 years go by and then 10 years, because you know, things move slow, but 10 years went by. And then finally in 2008, the FDA issued the proposed rule to change the pregnancy category labeling system. And they started really moving forward with that. And like you said, what they wanted to get away from the A, B, C, D, and X and include more of where they include the fetal risk summary, clinical considerations, meaning what giving that drug in a clinical situation in pregnancy would look like, and then what the data was and providing the data on what we have on each specific drug. So that's kind of when, and I actually remember because I just finished fellowship and I was at a meeting, and I remember they were talking about it. And then I never heard about it for years. And then we'll jump to when it finally went into place. But I was sitting there waiting. I was like, this has been like another 10 years. But again, this goes to show you how long it takes to get things like this done. So anything else that they were thinking about in 2008? I know they were researching this and made the proposal. But what actually took it so long to actually go into effect?
There was a lot of debate on what exact information needs to go through. And there was also, from what I understand, a lot of pushback from some of these companies that were going to have to enact this because it is a lot of extra work. It's going to change the entire process surrounding the risk versus benefit. And it was just not just for women, which we'll talk about here, egg-producing individuals, but also for infertility as a whole. So we're looking at both male and female infertility all across the board. We're looking at pregnancy. We're looking at lactation. We're going to have to add all this information into the package insert that wasn't there before.
Yeah, it was going to be a lot of work. And it was going to be a lot of work. And it was going to be a lot of work for the people that were changing it. It was going to be a lot of work for the drug companies to, you know, what information they were required to include. And then having access to the information, how it was going to look. And then how to put it in a digestible form so that if any obstetrical care provider wanted to look up a certain medication, they would be able to get to it and understand. So there was a lot of factors and a lot of things to consider before implementing this new labeling. Does that pretty much sum it up?
Yeah, that sums it up pretty well. I mean, it was just, there's so many moving parts that trying to get everybody on the same page. And I think that, it does stink that it took so long, but at the same time, I think that what they came up with in the end product was very good and it wasn't rushed. And that was, I think, a big bonus here is that the things that we are seeing now, because when new drugs come out, I usually read through the entire package insert because we kind of help decide as pharmacists, like what's going to be added to our formulary, if this medication is a good option or not. And part of my job working in the women's health side of things is to look at the pregnancy and lactation information. So if we do approve something to formulary, that we can determine that. And I find it so much easier now when these new drugs come out to look at that information. And it's so easy to digest and make a pretty easy decision on whether or not, yes, this can always be used. It's, you know, approved for that, or no, this is not okay. Or here are the clinical decision, you know, assistance that we can give you if this is a medication that you may want to use in pregnancy. So I think we've come to a good conclusion with that, but it was definitely a long, drawn-out process that I even remember in pharmacy school. It was, like, implemented. They're like, well, technically it's implemented, but who knows how long it will be before we start seeing this used in clinical practice.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's finally implemented through, in 2014, the publication of the PLLR, which is the Pregnancy and Lactation Labeling Rule, was published in 2014. And then 2015, it was implemented. So talk about what it's called, PLLR. What does that mean? And it's not, I guess it's like how instead of the pregnancy category labeling, that's kind of what it's considered because it also included lactation, right?
Yes. And so this rule required product labeling to be up to date with anything that's relevant to pregnant and lactating populations. The problem with this rule, though, is that it doesn't actually require collection of this data during clinical trials or studies. So these patients, if they were not in the study or if they were not part of that population that they were trying to study, so if this was something for heart disease, for example, and they said, well, there's not many patients that are going to fall in this category, they didn't have to still include them in trials. Age-producing individuals still had to be included, but not necessarily pregnant or lactating. So they could still be excluded. So that it's still in a step in the right direction. So we were able to see those things on labels, but not necessarily see those things in clinical trials. So previously it was, I believe, pregnancy, labor and delivery, and then nursing mothers was the prior labeling. And so now it was pregnancy, lactation, and then females and males of reproductive potential. And so those differencing in label categories have made it a little bit easier to see that information for those different populations. And I think that that is excellent inclusions of those different areas that maybe, you know, we weren't capturing, especially for male reproductive potential or trying to conceive individuals. They were really not getting any additional information. So sometimes avoiding stuff for pregnancy where it may not be necessary because those are later trimester issues versus first trimester when you don't know you're pregnant, things like that.
Right. And another great thing, and I'm all for this, I actually have talked about it on my account quite a bit, is what it, the PLLR ruling also required that any pregnancy registries, pregnancy exposure registries, needed to be included with that drug. So if you were taking nifedipine, and there's a registry where you can sign up for it, or you can tell your patient to go sign up for it, they will actually follow you and see, and that's a great way to see what outcomes are happening. You know, you're on it, you sign up for this registry, they kind of follow you through your pregnancy and postpartum period, and during, or even during lactation, just to see how you responded to it, you, get, you know, keep track of all that data. And registries are a really great place to get information for drugs and therapeutics in pregnancy and lactation. So that was required. And then what else was required? Then information about the existence of any pregnancy registry. And then you had to have contact information for the registries. And then also, and this was something we should be doing, is encouraging our patients that are pregnant and lactating who are on taking medications to enroll in a registry. You know, we don't talk about that enough, but it's not a hard thing to do. And I don't know why we don't do it more. I actually have to admit, I didn't start doing it until, you know, several years ago, but I haven't done it my entire career, but I do at any opportunity I can. Hey, this is this registry, think about signing up for it. Because again, it's a great way to collect information. Do you, as a pharmacist, do you guys ever talk to patients about getting on a registry?
I have in the past. I actually seem to do it more with like family members and friends because they'll reach out to me. And I'm a little more involved in that situation since I do currently work night shift. Most of my patients aren't super awake, but I have definitely for several of the patients, I'll like talk to the resident or the attending who's taking care of the patient, especially if we're doing something that's not as common. I'll say, hey, you know, we should really encourage this patient to be on the registry. And some of them weren't very familiar, especially the first year residents who are just starting out. You know, they're learning as well, the interns. So we've been trying to do that more and more recently. And the pharmacists tend to reach out, especially if we see a patient, for example, with like remdesivir or patients who are getting their COVID-19 vaccines. We've been really pushing for those patients to get on the registry. And if they have any questions, I have talked to several patients over the phone and like answered their questions about the registry if they were interested in learning more. And then I also do the same thing for friends and family. Anytime I hear that they'll ask me, oh, I'm on this medication. I was like, oh, have you signed up for the registry yet? Here's the link. You know, it's a very easy thing to sign up for, and it can make a huge difference in the future of especially learning about these medications. Not just in the pandemic, but a lot of these medications, the pandemic, we've gotten a significant amount of our information from these registries.
Right. So if you're pregnant or lactating and listening to this, and you're on any kind of medication, look to see if, and we'll talk about, actually, I'll tell you how to go find the registries, but at the end of this, but consider being on a registry. Just think about it. And maybe you'll look into it and decide you want to do that. But let's just talk a little bit about each of the categories. Let's talk first about pregnancy. In the new PLLR ruling, pregnancy would include labor and delivery, and there you need to include the pregnancy exposure registry, risk summary, based on studies that we have for that particular medication or drug in pregnancy. Clinical considerations. What exactly does it mean by clinical considerations? How would that be any different from the data component? Because that's the third and the fourth components of for the pregnancy labeling.
So what I've noticed in the clinical considerations for the newer ones that have come out are things that may alter the decision that was in the data, or things that were not included or specifically excluded from that. So if there was a certain condition that was excluded that may be relevant in pregnancy, that was also talked about. And they, if it was animal studies specifically, I've noticed in the clinical considerations, they talk about the differences between that particular animal and a human and where there may be pitfalls in the data. So it's kind of like setting you up to understand the data portion from what I have noticed in the recent publications.
Yeah, because, you know, just because we have studies on pregnant individuals for a medication, how that translates clinically might depend on how far along they are in pregnancy, what other medications they're on, what their weight is, because that can have a huge impact as well on how medications perform in pregnancy. If they're having, if they're twins, if they have certain kinds of medical conditions that might change their physiology during pregnancy. So there's a lot of things to look at. I wish we had so much just kind of breaking it all down. We don't. I mean, we still have a long way to go, but it's definitely better than what we did have. So I do agree with you there. You mentioned that before. It's definitely better than what we had. So the one thing, and you can, you know, tell me what your experience has been, that I found is that because, and let me back up, when that was implemented, it's there's different phases. Like new drugs are required to start with this type of labeling. Some of the older drugs had a certain period of time to change their package inserts and change their labeling and get that information together. So that's kind of in a stepwise fashion. It's probably still ongoing because this has just been, what, 6-7 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. So you might still get certain drugs that are still labeled as A, B, C, D, and X just because they haven't fallen into whatever they are in line to change their labeling. But any new drug obviously is going to have this new labeling. So is that kind of what you're seeing, that there still might be some that have the A, B, C, D, and X?
Yeah, especially drugs that were kind of approved before the full FDA process that are kind of grandfathered in, that weren't really following the rules in the first place, you know, because they were in that kind of backfill process. We still are seeing a lot of those drugs that have not switched over to that labeling. It's seen more and more. And I have found that a lot of the drugs you'll see in like Micromedics or Lexicomp, which are a couple of the big areas that I, or big resources that I use as a pharmacist, have at least switched over to where the category is not included, even if the package insert has not been updated. So it's a lot harder for somebody who is looking for that information actively to find the category, which I do appreciate, and it's more focused on the data that's available. We still have a ways to go. I feel like in the last probably 2 or 3 years, I've seen a pretty good increase on the number of package inserts that are including this information. So hopefully we're getting closer to the end of that. But the over-the-counter medications were not included in that, which is important to realize.
So yeah, the over-the-counter are not included in this new labeling. We did mention that, but that, and that, of course, that would include any kind of supplementation. They're not subject to the same thing as other medications, but like what kind of, give some examples of some of the over-the-counter medications that a pregnant or lactating individual might use that wouldn't have this PLLR labeling.
So things like Tylenol, things like aspirin, your common medications for any of the cough and cold, like Benadryl and things like that, that we see a lot of people using, Tums, you know, just those common medications that you can just grab and go at the pharmacy. So that's still a good opportunity to talk to your physician, talk to the pharmacist that's available to make sure that those are okay, because the information is not going to be available to you on that label.
Right. And then just real quick for lactation, for the new labeling, it's going to include risk summary, clinical considerations and data, And then for females and males of reproductive potential, it's going to include pregnancy testing, contraception, and infertility categories. So I wanted to, you know, we won't go into those in detail because I wanted to mainly focus on pregnancy, but that's kind of what you're going to see when you're looking for medications now and with the new labeling. Real quick, so because I want to talk about some other things, and we've been talking a lot about the history. More recently, as of 2018, we had the, what's called the PREGLAC Task Force. And what is that? What does that stand for? I don't think. Oh, here we go. Pregnant research specific to pregnant and lactating women is kind of what that is for. And that started in 2018. And what's that about? It's abbreviated PRGLAC, PREGLAC.
So it was part of that 21st Century CARES Act that helped with those knowledge gaps and research gaps for safe and effective women or therapies for pregnant and lactating women. So this is where the FDA Office of Women's Health that we talked about earlier kind of leads this committee. And it's actually part of the FDA committee to kind of more so provide guidance on this than what we had before in the FDA. And it's also making sure that there's a lot of representation for pregnant and lactating women in these task force. So they really help with like making recommendations on research and development of safe and therapeutics for pregnant and breastfeeding individuals. And so they started out and they made recommendations on those research and development. And now they've started working towards that implementation plan. So again, it's taken several years in order to do that. But they basically looked through and reported the kind of pitfalls that they were seeing in the research and development process.
Yeah. So, that's just a brief summary. There's a lot of things we didn't include that's happened, but these are just the main main points about where we, how we got to where we are today. And as you can tell, we started with 1977, we ended with today, and it's taken a lot of work, to get, egg producing individuals, pregnant, lactating, for, you know, those trying to conceive into studies, to be represented because we need that data. Now, I don't want to talk about the COVID vaccine, but I'm going to use it as an example. When the COVID vaccine came out, one of the biggest arguments was, look at the package insert. It wasn't studied in pregnant individuals, and it wasn't. And a lot of these drugs are not. But what people don't understand is if you look at the package insert on a lot of medications given in pregnancy, none of them were studied in pregnancy. What happens is after the studies are done, and hopefully that's going to change because we need to include them in those initial trials a lot more, is it called post-market studies is what we're doing in pregnancy. And that's where we get a lot of our safety data, our pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics data. Those are just two big words. PK or pharmacokinetics means when you give a pregnant individual or any individual, but a pregnant individual, a pill of, let's say, labetalol for hypertension. How does it distribute it? How is it distributed? What's the area under the curve? What's all the scientific aspects of how that drug gets through the body and is eliminated? Versus pharmacodynamics, or PD, means, in brief, you give them labetalol for hypertension. Does it decrease their blood pressure? Does it change, you know, according to their trimester? So what's the end result that we can see? So that's kind of a brief summary. But, you know, all of those studies are done mostly after a drug has gone to market. So that's why the package inserts will say it wasn't studied in pregnancy and lactation. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And that can cause a lot of confusion because there are a lot of great medications out there that were not part of those initial studies, but that does not mean we don't have good data to support their use. And you can have, you know, obviously clinical trials are gold standard. That's what we want in order for a drug to be approved in a certain population, any population. But you can still have very well-designed studies or very good data available for studies that are done post-marketing. Now, one of the things that comes down to is it's not typically funded by the drug company. They don't go through the same process going through the FDA. But those medications are often going through things like ACOG or Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine, where you have experts in the field that know the information, know what a good study looks like, and can make recommendations based on the information that we do have available.
Yeah, so I had done a video a few months back that was like the package insert argument needs to die. It just needs to die because when you're talking about pregnant and lactating individuals, most any medication that we would consider to be normal or, you know, given in pregnancy, if you go to look at the package insert, it's going to say this was not studied because those original studies are not done. So, but that's just how studies are done in pregnancy. Now, what we are trying to do is to start including pregnant and lactating individuals in those original studies, so that package is not just so the package insert won't say that, but because they need to be, right?
Absolutely. And the thing is, there's so many medications, you know, just taking the COVID vaccine, for example, we had already figured out that pregnancy was going to be a high risk category. Mm-hmm. And we were excluding those individuals from those studies that could have benefited early on from being included in those studies. And we would have had less of a gap where, you know, we had pregnant individuals who were concerned about taking the vaccine, you know, because they were missing data for such a long period of time. And so I think in some ways, the pandemic has kind of pushed that initiative a little bit further, because we realized that, you know, individuals need that data available, not just for the vaccine, but for things like remdesivir that we're giving, you know, when patients are hospitalized, these monoclonal antibodies that keep coming out. And what I've noticed is we've been more keen to give those individuals those medications now when their emergency use authorization right from out of the gate than we were probably even pre-pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, but look, you had sick pregnant individuals and you could not treat them. What were we going to do?
Exactly.
I'm not going to give you these monoclonal antibodies because we don't know. No, those patients were dying. So we had to do that. And, you know, so if we just start from the get-go doing these studies on anything, any kind of therapeutics or drugs, and including pregnant and lactating individuals, that's what where we need to be. But again, you touched on this earlier. Why is that not done? Obviously, people think about the ethics of it, and I get it. People think about the cost, because a company doing a study on a medication, adding pregnant and lactating individuals is going to add a huge cost to their study budget, if you will. But as far as I know, it's not a law that we have to do that yet, but hopefully we will get there, right? There's not any law that says that we have to include pregnant and lactating individuals, correct?
You're correct. There's no law at this time. It has been discussed. I have seen a few discussions where it has been brought up as a possibility. I was actually listening to the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, and there was a really good discussion that they were having about this. And kind of one of the things that they were hoping to push in the, you know, one of their agenda items was including that, because that's an area for not just pregnant and lactating, but I work in pediatrics and we come into a similar issue.
Kids,
you know, kids are excluded as well. But if we have patients who could benefit, they are consenting. We're aware of, you know, we've done the animal trials to kind of give us an idea of what the risk may potentially be. And obviously, if there's significant red flags, we're not going to go down that road. But, you know, if we don't have that, there's not a good reason why we shouldn't include those populations. And we're just doing more harm than good in some cases, right? Because we're waiting so long for patients to have access to those medications at times.
Right. So even today, a lot of the medications I give in my patients are based on studies done in sperm producing individuals or males, and non pregnant egg producing individuals or females. And, you know, that's not the same as someone who's pregnant. Bodies are physiologically different. The drugs are going to act differently. The dosage is going to be different. The timing of how, you know, how many times a day you give it is going to change. So we need that kind of data. And I was a part of the obstetric fetal pharmacology research centers for five cycles. They got rid of it, unfortunately, but that's what we were doing, was studying drugs in pregnancy, and even doing them opportunistically too. So we need more of that, and hopefully the NIH will find a way, or the NICHD will find a way to start funding those types of trials again. But let's hop to off-label use. We hear about that a lot in pregnancy or as well. What does off-label use mean?
So a lot of people talk about the package insert, so I will bring it up because that's where this comes from. So think of your package insert as your label, and the drug company goes through the FDA, gets approval for the FDA for specific indications. And we frequently use medications off-label because these medications, especially older medications that have been out for years and years and years, they only have a few indications that were actually studied for clinical trials. And then after that, once it's post-market, it's out into the world, we can do additional studies and we can find, oh, this medication is actually good for this other type of infection or for this other disease state or this different population. And that's what off-label means, is it's not the one that was initially pushed through, approved by the FDA. And these off-label uses, especially in the populations that I deal with, it's pretty much all I do because that is what is available, is these post-market data. It's very good data oftentimes that we can say that we have, multiple studies over large populations that say that this is safe to use. And so it's only just saying that they were not through that same long process of the FDA, but it doesn't mean that it's not good data, and it doesn't mean that it's not good research that is available for using it off-label.
Right, and some of the examples that you included would be, and people are gonna, it's gonna blow their minds, Zofran or ondansetron for nausea and vomiting pregnancy is actually an off-label use. Aspirin for the prevention of preeclampsia is an off-label use. And then for those of you who may have been in preterm labor or delivered prematurely, like myself, the magnesium for fetal neural protection is also an off-label use. But how do we know these things work? Because we had done studies to show that, magnesium was being used for other things, and it happened to show, we happened to do studies that show that it did help to protect the fetal brain for those that were going to deliver early, so that we use it for that. For example, I no longer use it for preterm labor, which when I was coming up, that's what we used it mostly for, but not so much anymore. So those are all off-label uses. And so there's a lot of off-label uses that we're doing actually in pregnancy and lactation, right?
Yeah, and that is where we get a lot of our data, from, is this off-label, because like we said, they weren't included in the clinical trials, especially those drugs that came out. There was a huge boom in drugs in the 1970s and the early 1980s for getting approved. And so unfortunately, egg producing individuals were excluded from that as a whole. And so, all of those drugs that came out during that time were not going to have an on-label use for pregnancy, but we can use off-label, we can use the data that we have available, and those studies are continuing to be ongoing for drugs that were, approved 30 years ago that we think maybe could be used in these individuals. And so, off-label use is not necessarily a bad thing. We would prefer, of course, getting those good clinical trials. That's, like we've said several times, something we want to push for, but that doesn't mean that it's not safe or any less safe than what we are seeing with on-label use.
And that's just it's important to understand that. I wish we had perfect studies in pregnancy and lactation to say we studied this and this is what it shows and this is how safe it is. Is it, we don't have that. But the key, why are we doing this, Dr. Richard and I? Because the whole point of this is for those of you that are listening or will listen to know that pregnant individuals don't all of a sudden not require medications because they're pregnant. They still require medications. They still have health conditions. They're still going to have complications in pregnancy that need to be managed and treated. So if we rely on what we know or what we don't know, what are we going to do? Just say good luck to them, or I can't, I'm not going to give. No, you have to treat them. And do we have to do off-label use sometimes? Yes. Do we have to do drugs that are not necessarily what would have been in category A or B? Yes, we do. Do we have to give them drugs that were studied primarily in males or sperm producing individuals and egg producing individuals who are not pregnant? Yes, we have to do all that until we get to where we need to be with research of drugs and therapeutics in pregnancy. So we do the best that we can. We always are mindful of what we're giving, but we can't neglect or orphan pregnant and lactating individuals from medications. And just tell them to deal with whatever it is they're suffering from, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I always like to say to my patients when I'm having these discussions with them is the person carrying the fetus has to be healthy in order for the fetus to be healthy. If you don't treat conditions that could be life-threatening later on, nobody's going to survive the pregnancy. And that's not what we want at all.
So as maternal fetal medicine specialist and a PharmD coming together that's on the same page, I really appreciate that because, this is something I deal with all the time. Real quick, what I want to say about the new PLLR for drugs and therapeutics. One thing that I've found is that it's more work for some obstetrical care providers than the previous categories, because the previous, it was pretty much black and white. This is a C or D, I'm not going to give it to you. But now they have to read what's available and counsel the patient and have more of a conversation with them, which is time consuming, is more work. And so I've actually seen a lot more referrals based on medications that don't have the A, B, C, D, and X anymore because it can take more time. but we need to do it. It has to be done. And that's the right way to do it. And that's informing the patient about what we know about certain medications that we don't have as much data on as some of the others that we do. So I've seen a lot more in that, more of that. And then I just want to get your thoughts on this too. I hear all the time, and I'm not trying to paint pharmacists in a bad light, but we had to talk about it because I hear it all the time. You know, I prescribe baby aspirin for prevention of preeclampsia, which is recommended by USPSTF. It's recommended by ACOG, SMFM. And then they'll go to get their baby aspirin and the pharmacist will tell them not to take it. Or other medications that prescribe. So where is the disconnect there and how can we make it better? And I just use baby aspirin as an example. Yeah.
No, and that is completely fair. So to kind of help the people who are listening to understand kind of my role being different than what they maybe see at their Walmart, Walgreens, that sort of stuff, I did additional residency training specifically in pediatrics and in women's health. And so I had additional training that allowed me to understand those conditions better. Unfortunately, I will say that pharmacy is not very good at pregnancy, lactation, or pediatrics. It's just not something that is taught in the general classes. I had to take an elective for pediatrics. I had one lecture that talked about medication use during pregnancy and lactation. Mm-hmm. And the education of pharmacists in the general pharmacist population, those who don't do the additional training, frequently are lacking in that information. And that is a huge issue that a lot of our organizations who have pharmacists, such as myself, who work with pregnant and lactating individuals and have heard that these, you know, patients are dealing with this, really have went across and said, no, we need to include this as a requirement. You need to be required to have discussions on pregnancy and lactation, not just a couple things. I mean, we were talking like basically in one lecture doing preeclampsia prevention, as well as gestational diabetes, as well as like two or three other conditions. And so there's no way you're going to get the depth of information that you need to adequately care for a patient in that situation. And so I would say that unfortunately, a lot of your general pharmacists do not have the education that I do in this population. Mm-hmm. They're not used to caring for that population as frequently. And that's where you're going to see a lot of the disconnect. So what I'm hoping you will see in the future, there is some recommendations to now require both pediatrics and pregnancy and lactation in our general therapeutics classes instead of making them as elective, which is what currently is all that's required. And also making it more of a requirement for boards. So right now there is very minimal amounts that are on board certification just for your general NAPLEX pharmacist boards on both pediatrics and pregnancy and lactation. So that is another direction to go down. And I would say that unfortunately right now for the general pharmacist, the education piece is lacking. Okay. And I hope that we see that change in the future because it's not appropriate. And it's not okay to just ignore certain groups of individuals, especially when you have millions of pregnant persons and lactating persons every single year. They're going to go into pharmacies. They're going to need medication. 9 out of 10 need some sort of medication during pregnancy. And that's just not okay. So, I don't know how else to say it. It's not okay.
I hope that gets better, and I'm sure that it will, but it takes time. But if you're an individual who was given a prescription for a medication and you're pregnant or lactating and you go to get it filled and the pharmacist refuses for whatever reason, what you need to do is tell your provider, this is what they said. They told me, you know, they said it wasn't safe or whatever. Have the conversation with your provider. And listen, as providers, we might have to pick up the phone and call and talk to the pharmacist and hash it out. What I don't want pregnant patients to do or lactating is to just not take the medication. And then I not know until 4 weeks later when I see you. And I thought I was giving you medication and I didn't know. Tell your provider, let them handle it as far as if they need to pick up the phone and call the pharmacist to get that prescription filled because they prescribed it for a reason. And pharmacist, you know, absolutely. If anybody's listening, you know, if you're concerned, you can also pick up the phone and call the provider. Yes, it takes time. I know nobody wants to do that. But we have to take care of patients, so it can go both ways. So until then, if we could just kind of do a better job of communicating with the prescriber and the pharmacist, the person that's going to benefit is the patient, which is what we want. So that's what we need to do. So I'm glad we had this conversation because, you know, as a PharmD, you're definitely more clinically educated as far as, you know, what to look for in these things. When they go to CVS or they go to Walgreens, they might be more likely to be say that I'm not giving you this medication, even though an MFM wrote it, like myself, and I've had that happen before. And I can't necessarily fault them, but what I can do is call and talk to them about it. And we just need to do more of that, don't you think?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, there's a lot of issues in pharmacy in general right now with staffing, just like every other, profession in healthcare right now. And I think that that's one of the barriers that some people face is that, you know, just trying to get on the phone and have time one of the things that they face in that world. I'm very fortunate to be in a hospital setting. So when I do have a question or concern, I can get on the phone with the provider. That's the first thing I do is, you know, I send them a text page and say, hey, I have a question. Like whenever you're done, you know, I know oftentimes they're off doing a delivery or something else. If it's not urgent, I'm like, hey, when you get a second, like, give me a call. And, you know, sometimes we'll talk for 10, 15 minutes about a certain medication. And sometimes we conclude that it was a good idea and we should go for it. Sometimes we're like, there was things that, you know, the provider missed and that I've been able to catch and have a discussion. And so those discussions can happen between professionals that can be very beneficial to the patient on both sides. It's just making sure that everybody is on the same page so the patient gets the best medication for them.
Yeah, and then we don't want to confuse them. I don't want to say, I just counseled them in our OB visit and said it was fine. Then they go to the pharmacist says it's not fine. They're going to be like, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, what am I supposed to do? And I can understand that's confusing for the patient. So, you know, just like everything, it's going to take time for us to get on the same page. But what we can do is just try to do the best thing for the patient. And sometimes that takes a little more time to hash things out. So I hope that all of us are more willing on both sides to do that in order so that the patient can be taken care of. One thing that I didn't go through one by one, but what I'm going to do in the caption of this video is put a lot of resources. And Dr. Richard, I had sent you that list. If you have any to add, send it to me of resources that you think might be good for patient use to look at, to get information on drugs and therapeutics and pregnancy and lactation. And I'll put what they are and what they specialize in so that you'll know where to go. But do you have, I mean, this is a great discussion. I love this. I think it's great to understand the history, great to understand where we stand today, what we can do to improve, and to tell individuals that are listening, you know, have the conversation with your provider. If you have a concern about a medication, when you're in the office with them and they're starting you on something new, talk to them about it. What I don't want you to do is take it home and throw the prescription away. And I think, or the provider thinks you were taking it. I've seen that happen a lot. So if you have questions, you can ask. So please ask. So that would be my last thing, my word of advice for those that are listening. What would be yours?
I would totally agree is ask every question that you have. Even if you think it's silly, even if you think it's minor, or even if it's something, you know, if you've been on Google and you have read something about this because you heard about it, ask the questions because, you know, oftentimes there's a lot of information that can be misinterpreted and it's not, your concerns are completely valid. Whatever you've read, you need to have all of those concerns taken care of before you start taking that medication because what you'll find is, you know, you'll come back in and where everybody's confused because we thought that you were taking a medication and only to find out you weren't. And we could oftentimes, you know, for me, I see them in the hospital, you know, we could oftentimes prevent hospitalization by having those really good, you know, question and answer sessions. You're not hindering anybody's time by asking questions. That's what those visits are for. And that's what that time is for. And so if you have questions using that and then the information that you had, like the different resources, those are also great to do in the interim if you don't have access to somebody in the meantime, using those. And then if you have more questions, call, ask those questions because they're very valid and important in order to make sure you're taking the medication as safely and as effectively as possible.
I agree. So thank you so much for this. This is excellent. I know this has been a long time coming. We had originally scheduled this before the holidays, but then I had to cancel on you. So I really appreciate your willingness to do this with me, and I'm sure we'll do things in the future. If you guys have anything that you want us to talk about, always put it in the comments. Always look at the comments because it helps me get ideas for future discussions. And again, you can find Dr. Richard on at Happy Farm Life here on Instagram, also on YouTube. So go check her out there. And thank you for your time, and I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day as well.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
you enjoyed that discussion. Now listen to the next episode on office gynecologic procedures and lack of pain control.